Welcome to another virtual podcast on Elaine's Literary Salon. I'm Jeffrey James Higgins. My wife Cynthia and I own Elaine's Literary Salon and Elaine's Restaurant. We've turned it into a literary hub for the DC area. To date, I've interviewed 173 authors, and I'm really excited today to speak with Don Mann. Don is a decorated combat veteran, motivational keynote speaker, athlete, and author. His autobiography, Inside SEAL Team 6, My Life and Missions with America's Elite Warriors, is a national bestseller and Washington Post political bestseller. He's here to discuss his recently released book, The Navy SEAL Playbook, Principles, Practices, and Strategies for Achieving Success. Don also writes fiction, and some of his recent work includes the SEAL Team 6 military thrillers, Hunt the Wolf, Hunt the Scorpion, and Hunt the Falcon. Other popular titles among his more than 20 books include The Navy SEAL Survival Handbook and The Modern Day Gunslinger. He lives in Virginia. You can find out more about Don at www.usfrogman.com, and that's Frogman with two N's. Welcome, Don. It's an honor to have you.
Thank you, Jeff. It's an honor to be here with you.
So I have to start with your background. When did you go into the military, and what was your motivation for serving?
Well, I went in the military in 1977. I graduated high school and tried a year of college, but I just couldn't see myself sitting behind a desk for, 4 years. The reason I wanted to join the military, my father instilled a sense of patriotism in the four kids, me and my brother and two sisters, when we were very young. And he and his two brothers and sisters were part of the Greatest Generation. And when we were attacked in Pearl Harbor, my father was in high school. He quit high school, joined the Navy. His two brothers quit what they were doing, joined the Army Air Corps, and his sister joined the Navy. And they stayed in the military till the war was over. And my uncle was captured and pitchforked into the ground. And he was a hostage. You know, he was kept prisoner of war and solitary confinement for a long time. So, but any time growing up, we would see something where veterans or military people were hurt or killed. I saw tears in my father's eyes, and the flag was so important to him. And when he retired, he became the state commander of Veterans of Foreign Wars. So he was 100% patriot. And when I decided to join the Navy, it was the first thing I ever did to make him proud, I think, you know. And that meant the world to me to make him proud. But I just always had a sense of patriotism. When I was growing up, the Vietnam War was going on. And, you know, when you're a kid, a 10-year war seems like a lifetime. So I was just sure I was going to go to Vietnam. But it ended a year and a half or so before I got in the military. And I was just going to do 4 years in the military. But when I found out about the SEAL program, I realized there is nothing in this world I wanted more than that. And while I was in, every time it came to re-enlist or re-up, I was thinking, I'm definitely going to do it. I was going to initially just do 4 years and get out. But it was so much fun being in the military. And so I did 21 years, served at SEAL Team 1, SEAL Team 2, and SEAL Team 6, twice at 6, once as an enlisted guy and then once as a warrant officer. And then got out and did 25 years as a contractor for the CIA. And I just love being a part of what's going on in our country. It's a small, small, small part, but I just love being part of it. And I know you have that feeling being retired DEA and everything you've gone through and seen. I think we probably have the same feelings about just wanting to support the effort in some way.
Do you feel like since you, well, first off, thank you for your service. It's an amazing career. You know, you mentioned, during Vietnam, and obviously the mood in the country was very different. And in recent years, it's been very different in some ways. You know, you sort of see these ebbs and flows. You talk about the patriotism that influenced you to want to join. Like after 9/11, there was a huge amount of patriotism, you know, across both political parties and things. And that certainly changed. Do you feel like it's increasing now again, or are we in a bad place?
I feel it's increasing again. I really do. I think it's also a sense like what's going on now with what we're doing in Iran and maybe China and Russia. It's a sense like our military needs all the support they can get now. As far as I'm concerned, we're the most dangerous place we've ever been in my lifetime right now. And for young men and women going in the military now, I think it's the most dangerous time. And so we need to support them. And I think people feel that now.
So I want to ask you, like, writing books, and you're prolific, right? 20 plus books. In the same way that, like, a child of, like, a wealthy person maybe doesn't understand how a dollar is made, and a lot of times in, like, a really safe society, like a historically in all of human history, safe society, people tend to not understand the dangers that are out there, except those maybe that are in law enforcement or those that are in the military. Do you feel that, like, having been there on that pointy edge, that you're able to, when you come face to face with the true dangers and realizing how fragile democracy is and how fragile security is, do you feel it's an obligation for you to write? Is that one of the things that, like, motivates you?
Oh, possibly. I never even thought of it like that. But I will say, when I start writing a book, I have to really feel a need and a cause. And part of it is to share lessons I've learned, for one, and I never set out to be a writer. The last thing I wanted to do was sit behind a desk. And the first book I ever wrote, I was involved in adventure racing, and I was competing at a high level and teaching it at an academy and putting these races on all over the world. And there's a Virginia politician. He said, "Why don't you write a book?" He said, "You're the only one who does this at this level." I said, I don't want to write a book. And he said, "You should write a book. You're the only one." And it was a fairly new sport. And I was thinking, well, I'll tell you what, I'll do it all on tape, but I don't want to type it in a computer. And he found a writer from Chicago Sun-Times. And it wasn't that bad. And I liked sharing what I knew about adventure racing then. But then when the book started turning more towards military and SEAL, SEAL type books, I felt an obligation to help support the military and the SEALs by showing the civilians what the other side of life can be like, what it's like being a SEAL and what it's like being in the military in general. And I thought that was doing a service for the military. And I still do. Every book I've ever written that had anything to do with the military or SEAL team. And I've talked with senior officers, admirals and generals, and they felt the same way, that these books only draw good attention to the military. And I can sleep well knowing that. I like that's how I hope most people view it. That's how I view it, though.
So when you talk about this adventure racing, like, I believe you've done, what, two triathlons? Is that correct?
Well, yeah, as one of the first guys to do an Ironman out in Hawaii, those were triathlons, which are still very, very popular. They're more popular now than they were. When I first started, only 15 people in the world had done one. And what it is, it's a 2.4-mile swim followed by a 112-mile bike ride, then a marathon, 26.2-mile run. And at the time I was doing them, it was the biggest race going for human endurance sports. And it took over my life, the sport of triathlons. I just loved it. But then I did Ironmans before I was a SEAL. And then when I retired from SEAL team, I thought, well, since I can do Ironmans in less than 12 hours, now my goal is to do two Ironmans in less than a day. And I did that after I was 42 years old. But yeah, I just always set things where I have a hard macro goal, I call it, and then a series of micro goals to reach up to that. So the macro goal was two Ironmans in one day. But I looked at it as, yeah, so what? That's 4.8 miles of swimming, 224-mile bike ride, and then 52.4-mile swim. I mean, run. But I was thinking, that's only one day. The adventure racing went to 10 and 12 days, 500 and 600 mile long. And adventure racing, and I don't want to sound too crazy here, but in adventure racing,
it's too late now.
we pushed ourselves to bleeding, passing out, or hallucinating. And that's what I liked about it, not because I liked to bleed or pass out or hallucinate necessarily, but I liked knowing that whatever I was doing, I was giving it my all, and I was leaving nothing back at the kitchen table. Everything I was doing is I was giving it my all. And as far as comparing adventure racing to SEAL missions and SEAL platoons and squads and small unit tactics and things like that, it felt the same way. You have your backpack on, you're not carrying a weapon, but you're surviving for 10 plus days without support. And, you know, we're biking and paddling and swimming and climbing. You don't do that in the SEALs, but you're still with a small group of people setting out doing something tough in tough terrain and trying to get to the mission, the final mission or the finish line. So it reminded me a lot of the SEAL program and training and SEAL missions. But adventure racing was the hardest thing I ever did in my life.
Wow. At least with adventure racing, nobody was shooting at you.
Nope. I did get held up once with a sickle and an axe. I got out myself out of that. But that was in the Himalayas. There were some rebels up there trying to attack us. But well, that was the only time.
They picked their victims poorly. So I got to ask, like, you know, when most people hear about like adventure racing or doing two triathlons in a day, they think that's insane, right? I mean, I've run marathons. Like, I was a distance runner for a long time. So I get the appeal for it. But do you think like there the same? I see the parallel with like being a SEAL, right? You have a lot of roles in the military, but even going through the training, the type of missions that you're involved with. I mean, it's so pointy edge of the spear. Do you think the what made you want to pick that out of everything in the military is the same thing that drives you for, you know, adventure racing? And is that something you're born with, or is that something you learned along the way?
Well, I think it is the same thing. And a lot of times people say, well, what type of person do you become after being a SEAL? And I think you're already that person before you go to BUDS, because why else would you want to go through BUDS? You have to have it in you that you're going to be punished. You're going to be put through the ringer. And then, you know, you've got a lot of PT in the next 6 months, and then you've got a hard job but I think that you have to have that in you before. And for me, I trace it back to fourth grade. When I was in fourth grade, you know, I didn't necessarily enjoy playing in the playground and playing whatever kids played with. I like going out in the woods by myself for what I thought was a long time and turning around and trying to find my way back. And then I'd get on my little bicycle and ride as far as I could and take all these side roads and try to find my way back. I just always liked that. And whenever I got a little older, you know, 14 plus, whenever we saw a hill on the side of the road, I'd ask my father to stop so I can go to the top of the hill. So I always liked nature and pushing myself. And I say nature, I mean the outdoors and pushing myself in the outdoors. I just always liked it. So when I heard about the SEAL program, you know, they're training in jungles and deserts and the Arctic and the ocean and all over the world, and they're working out like crazy and diving and shooting and blowing things up. That was the best day of my life, finding out that there was a program like that.
Did you find that like those personality traits of like self-assurance and adventure and you know and self-confidence and patriotism that like kind of led you to the SEALs, was that very common with the other team members, or did they all come from varied like motivations and backgrounds?
I would think it'd be similar to the DEA. I mean, you could get in a platoon or a squad, an assault team. You can get with a group of 7, 15, 30 guys, your small units, and you might have a guy who is a biker, a guy who used to help at church, someone who just hung around the couch and did not much, you didn't do much, or a hardcore athlete. You get all types of people, but the common bond was they're all willing to push themselves for a common goal, and that goal was the United States and our military. But there are all types of people. I mean, there are some crazy, crazy guys, you know, it was either prison or the military, and I guess I'll go the military, I don't know. And then they go into BUDS, and then there were some of the greatest SEALs we had. And then you had Naval Academy, you know, guys who retired as admirals, but when they came in, they went to a Naval Academy and they were the track stars or the running stars at the academy, just squeaky, squeaky clean. And they'd be side by side with the biker and they were best friends. But it was not so much the background that bonded them at all, but it's what they were focused on at that point in their lives.
Do you miss that sense of camaraderie now that you're out, and the sense of mission that bonded you all together?
Yes, I do. Because I really had, in the agency, we had it a little bit here and there, but it was nothing like in the military. And, you know, I stay in touch with a lot of the guys still. And we still talk about the old times and the old days like they were just yesterday. But we all miss those times. And, yeah, it was the best time of my life. And, yeah, I'm so happy. If I hadn't found the SEAL program, I don't think I would have done anything meaningful in life. I don't think if it wasn't the SEAL program or something very similar to it, I wouldn't have given it my all. And I found the career that I was able to give it my all. And I love that.
When you say like the agency was different, how does like the SEAL ethos compare to other branches into our intelligence community?
I don't want to be sarcastic. I didn't know there was CIA ethos, though. But there are. But they don't compare to the military. They really don't. You get over there, and you're with guys who are with former military, so you get that. But it's a little more cutthroat in the agency and big government. You know, when you get around the big government, or you get around your command and your military unit, you can say big government seems more cutthroat. And I say cutthroat meaning they don't always have your back like the military does. The military, they really look out after their own people. If they're hurt or down or need help, the military's there for you. And that, I didn't really see that so much in the agency.
What was it that drove your decision to leave the SEALs?
Boy, after 21 years, and I got out in 98, I was getting a little bored because we weren't that busy. And it's a terrible thing to say because after I got out, 2 years after, they got busy. They got busy, 9/11 and all. But at the time, we were what was called chasing rainbows. We're going after the action. We're just trying to find action where we could be SEALs and do what we trained to do. And but it wasn't that often that you'd find real work in the SEAL community during those years. We thought we found it. We thought we were very, very busy, and we were for that time frame. But compared to, you know, after 9/11, it was a completely different world. The guys and the girls, ladies who came in after 9/11, their lives were so much different than ours. I talked to guys who've been in, they came in because of 9/11. They spent their 20 years in, and in their 20 years, all they know is war. They spent 20, and that hasn't happened in our history before. We haven't had 20-year-long wars before. But so many, and just I think of what that does to someone's mind and their soul, you know. I mean, I had a buddy from SEAL team die this week, 2 days ago. I keep a list of all my SEAL buddies who died, and it's long. The SEAL buddies I was close with, I mean, there's a lot more, of course. But that list is long. And I heard one of the guys say once, he said, normally if someone's in six or seven, maybe people in his life may have died over a 20-year period. You might lose a parent, you might lose an uncle or a relative, but maybe it's four or five or six people may have passed while you're in. And he said right after the botched withdrawal in Afghanistan, he said this, he said, I've lost 45 close friends and family members since I've been in the last 20 years. And I lost a lot of them for this country. And he was crying. He was a tough SEAL. And he was crying. He said, my God, what did I do it for? What did I do this for? I mean, we just gave away all our weapons and ammo and our intel. And we were given our blood for this country. And now it's all over. I mean, what's the point? And he was just reaching out for answers. And we were on a Zoom call, a bunch of us. And none of us had an answer, you know. And you know, of course, a lot of guys get PTSD, so many. Probably almost all the guys. And but that type, just having that bothering and bogging down your thinking, like, what? I spent 20 years, why did I do it? It's a scar in itself, you know, the hidden scars the guys are getting, not to mention seeing his buddies getting killed and shot and shooting and killing people. I hope that was the right person. You know, you don't know all the things that someone can go through in 20 years of war. So I just can't even imagine the human toll, the scarring it's done on so many souls and minds and, you know, spirits and the guys and women who've been at war for 20 years. I didn't have that. I had 21 years, and we were chasing that action. We were chasing, and we were happy when we found it, and we liked doing that stuff. But it was a whole different story from after 9/11.
Looking back, do you see the irony in, like, you're a tool in the military to do a specific thing. So when you don't, when you're not being used, obviously you've done all this training, you want to be used, right? That's totally understandable. But at the same time, if you're not being used, it means maybe your country isn't in that danger at that time, you know, when you're in it and looking to be able to execute what you've been trained to do. Do you now look back and say, wow, that was, it's probably better to not have the missions available because they're not needed?
I couldn't believe that more. I mean, I am 100% among that mindset. Now, when you leave the action and you leave the team, and then you start questioning, like, is this the right thing to do? Is this the right war? We should be going into war now or not? Maybe not. Maybe we shouldn't be hitting this country like we are. And now I question it more because, well, I don't believe the news anymore. And I don't believe, you know, now that lies are kind of being exposed on certain wars we've been in, and we went to war for reasons we thought were different reasons. I think this generation's going to see the news differently, and what we hear, we're going to interpret it differently, and maybe not, you know, like, hey, I'm ready, I'll go. And that's how I was, and that's how our whole generation was. You tell us where to go, and we'll go. We can't wait to go. Let us go. But now, at my age, and after, you know, 45 years or so of service, now I question it more. Like, is this the right thing? Like, what's going on right now? I question it. You know, I know there's a lot I don't know what's going on, but I just, for the young men and women going in the military now and getting ready, you know, maybe going to Iran. I mean, if we do have boots on the ground, I mean, that might be one of the most dangerous missions I've known a large group in the military would go on at one time, since maybe Normandy, I don't know. So I'm worried about the guys and ladies now, and I just would feel better if I knew the reports we were getting on the news that's controlled, what they can say or can't say. I just wish when they go in, they raise the right hand, and they're going to go into battle, they knew the truth why they were going. That's what I just wish.
I think your skepticism in media is deserved. You know, I think you're absolutely right. You know, you mentioned like the PTSD and people coming out after all these years of combat and, you know, mission, deployment after deployment for decades. But you also talked about Afghanistan and that botched withdrawal. And I'm wondering, is in the community, are you seeing like any sort of formalized response to what that does? Because in a lot of ways, like, I mean, I had 67 foreign Afghan nationals that had worked with us that I was trying to get out after that withdrawal because we just abandoned them there, right? And so that, in a way, it's worse than being in combat in some ways, right? Like, it's like, is that something you expect and train for? And there's some support when you get out, people understand what you've been through. But this is something completely different that, you know, I guess, Vietnam would be the closest possible, the closest in our history, but is something that afterwards then to just give it all up. You know, like, is there any formalized response to that in, like, the special operations community that you know of that helps people maybe who've retired or the people who are still in who sacrifice and watch friends die for a war that we then just surrendered?
Well, I certainly respect and appreciate all you did during that time frame. And everybody who is there, they came back. And I know they all have difficulties with it. And I've heard all types of programs. I haven't heard of a program where anybody swears it works, though. You know, there's a lot that the VA's offering. There's a lot, you know, people equine therapy and people are going to Mexico and doing those psychedelic drugs and people going in the hyperbaric chamber. I hear, and people going on fishing trips and hunting trips with different VA groups. Randy Couture, an MMA champion, I mean, he's such a great guy, such a great patriot. But he had me in the ring once with his veterans that he supports. And he asked me if I'd just sit in there with him. And he had his ring in Vegas. And we're just sitting around the ring. And I'm sitting around all these vets. And the vet next to me, he said, yep, when I got back, my mother had an overdose. My younger sister died of crack. I mean, and then he had all these things he was going through. I didn't even have a story. You know, every veteran around that ring, maybe 25 or so veterans, their stories were horrific. And they were in Afghanistan and Iraq. And just the stories of them coming home, what they had to deal with is this example I just mentioned. But the stories that they had while they're over there, none of them were really spec ops, special operations type guy. Regular military, which is, of course, I'm not demeaning that in any way, but guys in the military, all branches, they had terrible, terrible situation that happened. And they are just reaching out for some sort of therapy or help. And what Randy Couture offered is, come to my ring once a week, we'll sit there and we'll just talk. And I think that emotional support, being around fellow vets, is the best I've seen to help anybody. I don't know if, hopefully people aren't taking medications and doing things like that, expecting that to help. But I think it's just the VA's, the veteran support, you know, however it's organized. If it's fishing or hunting or like sitting around a ring with Randy Couture or something like that, that's the best I've seen.
That's really cool that he does that. Do you think the efficacy of those types of like peer groups is better because they understand what people have gone through, as opposed to maybe like, you know, sitting with a team psychologist or something after a deployment?
Yeah, I think it's way better. Yeah, way better. Yeah. I think back to our team psychologist when we had to talk to him. I think it's way, way better. I mean, you can look at a person, he can tell you the most horrific story, and you just want to hug each other, you know? I mean, I don't think it gets better than that. I really don't.
There's probably a good lesson in that. So let's talk a little bit about your Navy SEAL playbook. That came out in February, correct?
Yeah, it just came out, yeah.
Well, congratulations, first off. I know you've done 20 plus books, but it's a big deal every time it happens. Tell us a little bit about it.
So a few years ago, we had a Commodore in the Navy, the highest ranking SEAL on the West Coast. And he was asked by a number of banking institutes to come up with a program where you can take the ethos and philosophies and the work ethics, things like that, from the Navy SEAL community, and what type of program he could put together to share with banking institutes. He did this in Minnesota, Texas, and he did it 12 different, we did it 12 different places a year. He retired, and then I took over his part. And the program he put together, I liked it a lot. But these bankers were just so thirsty to hear things. And it's not necessarily just the SEAL community, the military community, spec ops community especially. When they just heard some of the ways we did things, and I'm definitely here to say the way we did things, it wasn't perfect by any means. But I was almost shocked to hear that, wow, that's just the way of life it was for us. And I'm just sharing that with you. And these guys are writing it down. They can't wait to implement it. It's like they never heard it before. So, and then I was asked to do a talk for a country. They were from Norway, a company from Norway. And then I was really getting involved in the SEAL ethos and the principles and everything that we could share with businesses. And then my publisher from the early days of adventure racing called me, and we've been friends for now, you know, 20 plus years, asked me if I'd do a book on it. And I was thinking, yeah, because I see the value in it now. And I just took some notes now. Like one of the things that we have in the military, and I know in agencies like DEA and agencies like yours, is a strong commitment to what we're doing. That's powerful, because when I got out of the military, I realized not many people are motivated. I mean, I like goal setting. A lot of people set their goals low, they reach them, they go home, and they're happy. I mean, we always set our goals high and go after them. And if you can't get it, go after them again. But the thing about just being committed to your work, to the focus of the mission, to the objective, that the whole team is focused to that and they're committed. That was one of the things. And we find growth through discomfort, we say. You know, PT, of course, Hell Week and all that. I'm not talking about that type of discomfort. But what I would do, I'd Team 6, come in the morning, and I'd see the XO's car there. Say, wow, he's here early. And I always came early, too. And I'd go up there and just see him working away and PTing and shooting and working. And then I'd leave 6 or 7 at night. A lot of the cars are gone, and his car is still there. Sometimes I'd stay later in his car. He was the hardest working guy at the team. And so what that did for me is I realized I never want to let him down. I want to work as hard as he does. And I want to feel like I'm a valuable asset to him. And a leader, CEO, commanding officer, executive officer, they make you feel like you're part of the team. And no matter how junior or inexperienced you might be, you're part of the team. So there's a round table, you're discussing how training or a mission might be. Everybody has an equal voice. And you don't get shut out if you're junior. And that was a big part of the lessons we would share. You know, we always try to train our replacement, you know, like I know, you know, I'm going to retire in a few years. So this guy here, Jimmy, I'm going to just take him under my wing and I want him to replace me and I want him to do a better job than I'm doing. And it was just that feeling. Everybody had that feeling. So I did write the Navy SEAL playbook and I put down in that book the lessons I learned, mainly from great leaders I had. And how I looked at those leaders, how I, as a leader, would look at other folks above the chain of command and below the chain of command. And I just put down a group of a long list of lessons in the Navy SEAL playbook.
So did you find it surprising that outside of the military, because you'd been in for so long, that other like civilian organizations weren't as mission driven and they didn't teach leadership? And they didn't have that cohesive, you know, sort of team effort to go, you know, to achieve a goal.
Absolutely. And you know, I do talks around the country, which was nice because yeah, I've done maybe 300 or so talks, motivational talks. And so I know the military and I know the government agency and I know sports. So those are three things I knew. That was basically it, though. I didn't know anything about the rest of the world. So doing these talks and you get to talk with, you know, bankers, like I mentioned, cooks and medical people and people of all walks of life. And the reason they have motivational speakers come in there is try to motivate their team. They all had the same issue. We can't get our team motivated. But when you see the people, some of them, it's usually the leaders. They're solid. You know, they're solid, solid people. And then you see people like texting and while they're working, you go through the workspace and, oh, I don't know where Joe is. I guess he took off. He was going to go take his daughter to a dance or something. Who knows? He should be back tomorrow. And it was nothing like the military, you know? Yeah, so it kind of shocked me. It shocked me that not only they set their goals low, but they weren't committed to their job or their mission. Not in all cases, but in a lot of cases, I saw that in different industries and businesses around the country.
Do you think the difference is the disconnect is between because of the stakes and that, you know, you're talking literal life and death in the military and sometimes achieving things that are almost unachievable or, you know, or what do you credit as being the problem with like these like other non-military groups? And not being able to get that level of commitment because I mean technically they all win, right? Like if you're in a if your company's making more money, people make, you know, your job is secure, you can earn more, so there's something to be gained by it.
Well, I hate to take the easy way out by giving this for an answer, but I think it's the leadership. You know, you could have a super solid motivated CEO, but if those skills and traits and ethos that person has isn't spread throughout the command or the business, and it just stops up at the upper ranks. I think that's a problem. I've seen that happen before. In the military, that doesn't really happen because the leader is the guy you want to support. And we have sea daddies and those are people you'll go anywhere with, you'll do anything with. And if you get in trouble, like what would he do? You know, you have a sea daddy. And a lot of times that is a senior leadership. And in the civilian organizations, I saw where it was kind of weak down at the lower ranks and lower groupings of people. I saw they weren't committed. Maybe the CEO was great, but the CEO wasn't the type of person to let that out, what drives him. And if that person was able to say, this is what drives me, this is the mission, this is us. I'm the CEO and this is my team. I'm nobody without my team. We are one solid team. I need everybody's input. I mean, I'm so privileged to be with you all. I mean, if everybody on the team felt important and felt like their input was needed, that works in the military. And I've seen that not happen in civilian organizations where they haven't been productive or very efficient.
Do you think that failure of leadership is from a lack of communication, or is it a lack of ability within the leaders to understand how they have to generate enthusiasm and commitment from the people below them? Or is it maybe an insecurity about their position itself, where they're worried about their direct underlings maybe becoming too effective?
I think it could be any of those. I often thought mainly one of the biggest reasons would be in the military, it's structured. And when you're an E3, you're in charge of two people who are E1s and E2s, and you have leadership at that level. When you're an enlisted five, you know, E5, if you're a second-class petty officer or a sergeant or a corporal or whatever, you do have some people under you. So you're getting leadership every time you go up in rank. And when you're finally a senior enlisted or a junior officer or a mid-level officer, you have 20, 30, 40 people under your command. And then before you know it, you know, you've got hundreds of people. But you learn the lessons along the way up. So by the time you are leading a group of people, a large group, you've been vetted many times as a leader. And that doesn't happen in civilian world.
So is this book geared more for the corporate world, or is it individuals, or who is your readership here? Who's your target reader?
You know, initially I thought it'd be for the corporate world. Initially I thought these lessons are going to be for business leaders who want to take lessons, learn lessons from the SEAL community. That's why I initially put it together. But as I was working on it, I started morphing it into not only business leaders, CEOs and professionals, but also people. This is lessons for people. If you're a father, if you're a gardener, it doesn't have to be for corporations, because the lessons, some of them are specifically for business, but a lot of them are for basically anybody. Just, it's like, I kind of realized I let 25 close friends look at it before it was published. And a lot of them got more out of it as people. They'd see it be more valuable for just people, not so much the business world. But it was initially written for the business world, and then I morphed it into so it's for an individual person and whatever that person might do.
So let me ask you, how like you personally, how do you take these principles, the SEAL ethos, the principles of leadership that you're talking about, how did you apply them to your new career, which is, you know, your writing, your speaking, all the other things you're doing?
Well, I do have the right answer for that. So going back to the early Ironmans, the most famous Ironman in the world, King of Kona, his name was Dave Scott, and he's won Hawaii Ironman 7 times. And I asked him before his first Ironman, I said, Dave, how do you stay in such great shape? And that morning I asked him, and that afternoon he was a winner of another Ironman, his first Ironman. He said, well, Don, I just don't take any days off ever. I work out every day. And the doctors tell me I'm wrong. I work out every day. So I light bulb went off. And then I worked out every day that year. And then every year for the next 20 plus years, I worked out without a day off. So to answer that question, I expanded on what Dave told me. And because working out's not the only thing in life. It's a part of it. And it was an important part of it. But there's so many more things more important than just working out. So I took Dave's advice he gave to me, which helped me out a great deal in my life. And I said, when anybody asked me, I should say, when anybody, a child, an adult, I love it when like a 12-year-old or a 13-year-old wants to, like they might say, how do I become a Navy SEAL? But they can say, how do I become a basketball player or a mountain climber or something? But if you want to do something physically hard is how I formed my answer. And I said, basically, Dave Scott told me to do one thing every day, and that's work out. Basically, my answer is, all you have to do is four things every day, just four things. And that's the advice I wish that was given to me as a teenager. That's the advice I love giving to anybody, but it's the advice I follow myself now. And those four things, every day, get up and get stronger. Do something to make yourself stronger. Go in the gym, in the garage, go to, you know, CrossFit, go work out somewhere. But every day, do something to make yourself stronger. Number one. Number two, if you want to be a SEAL, number two, do something to make yourself faster. Do sprints, do wind sprints, do fartleks. If you could do 120 sit-ups in 2 minutes, do 125 in 2 minutes. But every day, do something to make yourself stronger. Every day, do something to make yourself faster. Number three, if it is a SEAL community you want to get into, every day, do something to make yourself smarter. So read about what the guys were doing, you know, back in Normandy, you know, what the team guys were doing back then. And then in Vietnam and, you know, leaving the beaches and going in the jungles and fighting there for 10 years. And then what happened, you know, in Grenada and Panama and these other places. And then what's going on, the 90 plus countries they're in now. And then look at the training they get. Learn to go to NRA, go get weapons qualified, go get skydive qualified, go get NAWI or PADI certified so you can become a diver. But every day, do something to make yourself smarter for what you want to do. And then I think the most important thing is, the fourth thing is, every day do something good for somebody. So if you see the man struggling, you know, he's got a bunch of leaves, he's trying to haul out to the road, just go over there and say, hey, let me help you out. If you, your mother, if you're a young boy or girl and you want to help, your mother's upstairs doing dishes, mom, let me do the dishes for you. So if a 12 or 15-year-old hears this and they do this, and then they go to selection or they go to BUDS or they go to whatever they're training for, they just might be the strongest, the fastest, the smartest, and the person everyone wants in their team because all they do is good for people. And that's what I do now still. And of course, I'm not getting stronger every day, but like for instance, right before this, I was on a run. It was a long hill, it was 7.15 miles. And I was doing these wind sprints up this hill and I had to go faster each and every time. I climbed Everest and I got hurt on Everest a few years ago. And my lungs have scar tissue in them now. So now I have pre-Everest times and post-Everest times. The way I used to lift and work out and run and bike and paddle and all that before Everest, those times are faster. So now after Everest, now I have something to chase. I'm trying to chase down those times before Everest. So as long as you have a target and you're trying to, and you can record it, you should record it, so you know you're getting stronger and faster every day. But record this stuff, and before you know it, you never get out of shape. You stay right with what's going on in the news or whatever's going on in the training, and then you're just doing good for people. That's what I follow now, and that's what I wish I started as a younger boy.
That's great advice. And the Everest story is really interesting. You had hypoxia, is that right?
Yeah, well, you know... I was the oldest guy on the team, and Lydia Bradley was on the team. She summited seven times, and she summited first woman without oxygen, just a hardcore woman. And she said to me, she goes, Don, I mean, we're up there for about 2 weeks, and she goes, this isn't bothering you, is it? You're the oldest guy on the team. It's not bothering you. I said, well, thank God. I don't know why. I'm just so happy. I couldn't be happier being up here. Then our doctor got HAPE and HAIS, high altitude pulmonary edema and cerebral edema. And pulmonary edema is where your lungs fill up with fluid and you have a hard time breathing. And cerebral edema is when your brain cavity, the space between your brain and the lining in the skull, fills with fluid and it starts pushing on your brain. It's called cerebral edema. So our doctor got medevaced for having HAPE and HAIS, and our other Sherpa did. And then... we're on the ice wall and I was climbing and one of these little cave-in ladders. And I was having a hard time climbing because I was having a hard time breathing. Then it started getting dark, but it really wasn't getting dark. The pressure on my brain, I was losing my night vision, my color vision. So it got dark. And then I forgot why I was on a ladder. I lost my memory. I lost my color vision. And then I couldn't breathe. When I put my head down, just water came out of my nose and mouth and just pour out. And so I got to the top, and we were fortunate enough to have Andre Dorje Sherpa, the most famous Sherpa in the world, who saved a lot of lives up there. He was our Sherpa. And I woke up and I looked up, I passed out, and he said, "Can you walk?" And he saved a lot of people who had hape and haste, but also people died in his arms who had it too. So he knew what he was looking at. And I just put my arms on his shoulders and had his oxygen mask. And we're trying to make it down to this cliff where you had to do a 100-foot rappel. And I couldn't talk anymore. I was just coughing and choking. And when I was breathing, it sounded like it was from a fish tank or something. It was just loud gurgling. And I'd collapse and pass out during the hike to that cliff where we had a rappel. And it was dark for me. I thought it was dark out, but it wasn't dark. And he said, "Can you rappel?" And I felt like saying, "I've rappelled all my life. Of course I rappelled," but I couldn't speak. And so he rappelled, and I had my harness on. I had my rappel device, figure eight. And I got the rope. He went down, and I was looking. I was thinking, I forgot how to rappel. I forgot how to rappel. simple technique. But I did see that morning a Sherpa wrapped a rope around his arm like 8 or 10 times, and he went down releasing one loop at a time. And he made it down to the bottom. So I didn't know how many loops to loop, but I just 7 or 8 loops around my arm. And I did the same thing. I just went off, releasing a loop off my arm each time and stopping the whole thing from spiraling off. And I made it to the bottom. And so when I got back to base camp, they found a doctor to come look at me. And she said, "We got to get you off the mountain. Your lungs are like 75% filled with fluid." And she had people come listening to him because she never heard anybody that bad. And I wasn't even thinking. I didn't know what hape. I didn't even think of hape or haste. My brain was just not functioning at that point. And I just knew I was in a tent away from everybody else. I'm not coughing and choking, keeping everybody else up. And then I just take my oxygen mask and just wipe all the stuff out of it. And then they said, "If you don't get a helicopter ride out today, it's not looking good for you." And they said it in a great way. I understood what they were saying, like I was going to die, you know, but I knew what they were saying. And then the helicopter couldn't come in because the storm was so bad. Then the next morning I was in worse condition and the helicopter couldn't make it in. Then that next afternoon, a Swedish helicopter pilot made it up there without oxygen. And this was televised on Discovery Channel. Everest Rescues, and they televised this rescue. And the helicopter pilot said, "I don't have any oxygen, but I came here to help you out if you need to get down." And he said, "What's wrong?" I was trying to say, "I've got hape and haste," but I was just coughing and choking. We just went down for an hour, straight down that mountain to Kathmandu. And that was, that was 9 years ago. And I still have, repercussions from that. But no regrets. I am so glad I did it, because I would have hated to have been the person all my life to say, "I wish I had done that. I wish I had gone for that." Because I'm enjoying life. And now I'm still doing everything I used to do. I just do it slower. But it gives me a goal to try to reach those times now. I haven't, but I'm not going to stop trying.
I love that, Don. That's really something special. Did you ever keep in touch with that pilot who took that risk without oxygen to come get you?
I never really knew much about him. I remember meeting him and my brain was all foggy. But when I watched the Discovery show, I see him and I recognize him. And I'd love to try to find him. I should try to find him. Because Discovery called me before I went there. And they said, "Hey, we heard you're going to Everest." And I was a combat medic. And so I was in the mountains a lot, and I've helped a lot of people. And they said, can you help us out if the rescues are going to be a lot this year? Because last year was the worst year ever on Everest. And the year before was the second worst year. So we think this is going to be the worst year. And it was all the avalanches, all the snow and ice coming down all from all the mountains. And it was scary. You just heard avalanches day and night all the time. And the year before, everyone got killed at base camp. The avalanche came through base camp. And so some of the guys on my team, they'd show me pictures. They'd say, we were just luckily we weren't at base camp when this avalanche came through. But this was the remnants of my tent. And the doctor I told you who came to rescue me, she's a well-known doctor. And she was there saving lives when the base camp was, you know, hit by the avalanche. And she got hit in her thigh. And she took a needle and thread, and she got hit with a block of ice or a rock or something, but a big gash in her thigh. And she sewed it up by herself. She sewed up her leg, then went on saving lives. So I had Andre Dorje Sherpa, the greatest Sherpa in the world, who got me when I was unconscious at the top of the ice fall. And he saved me getting down at base camp. And then this doctor who I learned about afterwards was the doctor who actually saved my life. And she's the one who said, the best bedside manner possible. Yeah, we got to get you down or it's not too good. You know, but she did it in a good way.
You know, it's such heroism, right? And all for all three of those people that saved your life up there. And I'm sure you did it many, many times yourself as a combat medic. It's inspiring. I'm really glad you've written about these types of things. How much do these experiences get into your fiction?
So Ralph Pizzullo used to work for Oliver Stone. And he's a famous writer. He's written a lot of books. And I was just thinking one day that Forrest Gump was such a great movie. And my mother had just passed away. My mother and I, there was one movie we both loved, and that was Forrest Gump. And I liked the soundtrack, the rock and roll and all that, but she didn't care for that music so much, but she liked that. And then I started thinking about Forrest Gump. It was a fictional character. It was fictional, but he brought us through a history lesson through Vietnam and Watergate and Johnson and Kennedy. And he brought us all, and then the Vietnam War. And he brought us through a history lesson. Then his girlfriend, Jenny, dying of the virus, which was AIDS. And I was thinking, you know, if I was a really good writer, I would probably try to create a fictional character, a SEAL or an agency guy, and have him bring us through history. And that's where my idea of the fiction came about, based on reality. And so I called somebody. I had his contact. His name was Thomas Sawyer, and he was the writer for the TV show Murder, She Wrote. So he's a well-known guy. I don't know how I ever had his contact information, but I told him about this idea. He said, Don, I love that idea. I would love to be part of it, but I am so busy with these TV shows. But one of my closest friends, Ralph Pizzullo, who's got a great resume, great bio, he's worked a lot with the State Department. He's one of the best I know, and he's working for Oliver Stone right now, but I know that's coming to an end. You should contact Ralph. So I contacted Ralph. He and I had the best conversation, and he said, can I come see you out in Virginia? And he lived in Hollywood. So he came out 2 days later, and I told him my idea, and we called that. And so he took my bio, and he fictionalized things I had gone through. And then we called it Hunt the Wolf, like you're hunting the bad guy. And but the character wasn't me. You know, people say, I know who that was. That was you. I said, yeah, if my life was 1,000 times more exciting, it would be me. So we and the publisher liked it. And then he asked for another book. And then that series went on to a series of 8 books. And it was based, Ralph made, when we worked this together, I came up with the big picture things, the country it was going to be in, the tactics, and all the team members were buddies of mine in the teams. We just fictionalized them. And he fictionalized the main character, Thomas Crocker, and made it into me without, you know, just exaggerated it all to make it more exciting.
So I'm always curious with like a co-writing project like that. So you were a lot of concept. Was he doing the nuts and bolts, like laying down the copy for the chapters and then coming back to you for checks, or how did that work?
Yep. So I think, gosh, it's 23 books now I've written, and about half of them I've done without a co-author. But for instance, and they're all up here on the wall right now, but I had a CIA guy. He's one of the smartest people I ever knew. And we did a book on piracy called Crimson Waters. And that was a great story because we did a lot of research on all the pirates. And what shocked me on that was the most brutal pirate in the world. She was a Chinese Muslim woman, way worse than Blackbeard or any of the pirates we heard. And then we did a book together on history's assassins, why people get assassinated and who the assassins are and what their motives are. And we found out that most of the times when people wanted to assassinate a person, they want to assassinate the person so that person can't stand for what that person stands for. But it usually backfired, and that person's stance gets all the more popular, kind of like what happened with the Ayatollah, I believe. You know, he was killed, and now maybe his cause is maybe being amplified now in Iran. So I had three co-authors. The Navy had called, and they said, you know, the Army has a survival manual. The Marines have a survival manual. The Air Force has one. The Navy SEALs don't have one. Would you do a survival manual? I said, I don't want to do a survival manual. They said, we'll give you an extra year up front. And we'll pay you up front. I said, okay, I'll do a survival manual. And then when I went to the agency, I was as a weapons and tactics instructor, and I had all this material. And my boss came in. He goes, man, you got so much material here. You got to write a book on weapons training. I said, no, I don't want to do a book on it. He says, you got all the information here. So that was another book. So it all came together like that. Never like a plan to write a book, but just people who I got to know and like a lot. And the Hunt book, it was my idea to write that. And then that just went to 8 books. But mostly it was the boss asking me, the Virginia politician asked me to write one. And that was the adventure racing book. And it was normally things like that, the Navy asking to do the survival book.
I've spoken to a lot of authors, and I don't think I've ever met one who was sort of like encouraged to keep writing books like that. Like, you have so many books, you know, you know, that, I mean, so really 23 books, that's amazing. That's a heck of an accomplishment. Doesn't surprise me at all based on your track record and how you've applied these principles that you learned in your other life.
Oh, thanks. Thanks. It's my high school teacher would be rolling over in her grave if she even thought I read a book, you know. So it's been a nice journey going from that to writing now.
Well, Don, congratulations so much on all this work. Honestly, I have so much more I want to talk to you about, but we're at almost an hour. Oh, okay. So I would love it if you would come back when you have your 24th book out. We would love to interview you about that, because I have a lot more I'd love to talk to you about.
Thanks, Jeff. And thanks for all you've done in your career and all you're doing now. And I look forward to staying in touch and doing this again with you.
Absolutely. And if Lane's Literary Salon can help you in any way, please let me know. I'm happy to. We have a really nice community. So you're part of it now. So welcome.
Thank you, Jeff. Thank you very much.